Morning, guys. How are you? Tad did a great job last week getting us started by looking back at the fact that God was working in creation before we were ever on the scene. And what we want to do over the 6 weeks is to look back a lot, see what God was up to as far as the Bible will let us see. We want to look forward a lot, see as far as we can into the future that the Bible will let us see. And we'll talk about now, all the pluses and minuses about work now. And what we're going to do is kind of draw a line between God's work past, God's work now, God's work in the future, and hopefully each one of us by the end of the time will be able to connect our work to God's work. We'll be able to see what it is that he's up to in the world and in us, and we can connect somehow to that, because if we're going to find any meaning out of our work, it's not going to be just by finding a couple tips and tricks to get through the day, 5 minutes for social time and 5 minutes to refocus. That's not going to do it. It's going to be by connecting ourselves to what it is God's doing. And so he showed us, Tad showed us, that God was at work before we were ever around in creation. In the created account, he is moving across the waters, creating from nothing everything that is. And we can get caught up sometimes, I think, as Christians, when we think about creation. We can get caught up in the times and the dates and how long everything took. There are theories about creation that, you know, everything's literal days. That's a pretty widely held orthodox belief. There are theories that each day represents an age, and that there were seven ages of God's creation. There's a theory that there's a big gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, that he creates the heavens and the earth, and then maybe a billion years passes and he recreates everything in creation. Those are valid orthodox, and we get hung up on some of these ways of seeing Genesis, but I think what Tad showed us last week is the primary focus. It's going to be one of the points on the handout. The primary focus of God's creative work in Genesis 1 and 2 is how God ordered creation. Not as much how much time it took, not as much was it a 24-hour day, but really the order of creation. God created canvases, water, land, heavens, and then he painted on the canvases by populating them with created things. This is a really big deal because it makes a shift from God just working in the background before we're on the scene to now he's actually preparing for our work. He's now moving in creation. He's beginning to prepare the ground, literally, prepare the ground for the work that's to come, first by Adam and then by us. And the reason that is point number two, God could have created a completed earth, but he chose not to. It still needed cultivation to make it fruitful. He provided the raw materials, but left the work to be created by man. Take a look at Genesis 2. It's there referenced in the outline. Verses 5 and 6, when no bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land, and there was no man to work the ground, and a mist was going up from the land and was watering the whole face of the ground. So you see right here, God has created the heavens and the earth. He's doing things, and here it says that there was no bush of the field in the land, and no small plant had sprung up, because there was no rain and no man to work the ground. So right below the surface, God has bushes, plants, trees ready to go, but it's going to need rain, which he hasn't brought yet, and it's going to bring man, who he hasn't created yet, to stir the ground and to cultivate it, to get it going. And that is, I think that really happened, but it's also symbolic, I think, of what God has done in creating things the way he did. He chose not to create a completed earth. Another way to say that is, everything that would have been needed for the technology of the wheel, the printing press, penicillin, the combustion engine, commercial aviation, microchips, GPS, Siri or Alexa, depending on who's your favorite, whatever we needed to do those things was, in a sense, in existence at the very beginning of creation. God, in a sense, buried literal raw materials in the earth for us to discover thousands and thousands of years later. He buried ingenuity into the brain of man so that each generation would build on the discoveries of the generation before. But the reality is, no human being has ever made anything from nothing. We've taken different raw materials and put them together in different ways to make significant things and significant progress, but none of us has been like God in that we've created from nothing. And God didn't have to do it that way. If he wanted to, he could have just created everything that was needed right there. And for generation upon generation, we could have just been taking care of the same things over and over, just like our dads did. But God, being the gracious and loving God that he is, he aims for our work to be meaningful. And what starts out with just cultivating some ground so that bushes and trees can pop up turns into us. We look at the technological marvels that we have in our day. And I think it should humble us to know that we're not necessarily any smarter than the generations that have come before us. But God has actually just revealed and unearthed a little bit at a time for us as humanity to continue to do and have significant work as we continue to do what God would have us do. And it's important. It's almost like God's hiding these Easter eggs out in creation for us to figure out and to find. And every generation thinks they're a little bit smarter than the one before because they found them, but we're not. We're just like everyone else, but we're doing something meaningful. If God had decided to create everything completed from the very beginning, it would be similar. I think there's a story that comes out of the Holocaust, and some people say that it's factual and it happened. Some people say it's more legend or anything. But among all the atrocities that were committed against the Jews, including the deaths of millions, one thing that maybe have been just as cruel is there's stories of in the camps, while they were waiting to decide what to do with these people, they would put them to work. And what the work would be in some of these cases would be to load heavy rocks up on carts, haul them to the other side of the camp, dump the rocks, pick the rocks back up, load them all the way to the other side of the camp, and dump the rocks literally over and over and over all day long until they were exhausted and went to bed, assuming that they were going to meet their death at some point in the future. In a sense, that working back and forth, and just as a man, I feel the futility of that, of knowing I'm not making any progress. I'm not making anything out of these rocks. I'm just going back and forth and back and forth until I die. And as horrible as that is, God, in a sense, being God, could have created everything in such a way that it was already done. I'm not going to involve humanity to do things as more inefficiently than I would. I'm going to effectively, figuratively, let them move rocks back and forth and back and forth while I execute my plan to perfection. God's too loving and gracious for that. Instead, he distributes knowledge and discovery over thousands and thousands and thousands of years of his created order so that we could be a part of real, significant, meaningful work. And so in that, we see God beginning to work on our behalf by preparing work for us because the earth still needed cultivation to make it fruitful. So the next thing he does is he plants this garden, Genesis 2:8. He plants a garden called Eden, which means paradise. Eden was a perfect place of peace. It was free of hostility and conflict, anger, anxiety, resentment, and envy. Peace is an interesting word. The word that the Bible would use for what this is shalom. We've all heard the word shalom. Peace in our world typically means the absence of conflict. It's what we want. It's not war. It's peace. And I would say, as the father of four and three, you know, nine and under, literally for me, peace is the absence of conflict. I mean, that's all we're asking for. If everybody's just not fighting, we are good. That is Eden, as far as I'm concerned. But the way the Bible talks about shalom, it's more than that. It's not just the absence of the bad and absence of conflict. It's actually the presence of everything good. It's the presence of everything needed. There's, like with most Hebrew words, it's a word that means a lot of things, not just one English word. And it's this fullness, this flourishing that can only happen when all bad things are, in a sense, banished and all good things are present. And so it's not just a lack of anxiety, a lack of hostility. It's the presence of pure joy, pure peace. It's the presence of everything good. It's the presence of God himself. And that's what Eden was. It was the original temple where God and man communed in a sinless relationship. We see that in Genesis 3:8. Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed before each other and before God. Without sin, there was no reason to cover up. There was no reason to hide. Shame was completely absent. So here we have kind of the fullness of that shalom. It's free of hostility and conflict and anxiety, but because God is there and there's no sin, there's no reason to be shameful. Because there's no reason to be shameful, there was no fear. See, shame and fear are always going to be partners. Wherever there's shame, there's fear. And wherever there's fear, just think about our own lives. Where there's fear, there usually comes hostility, conflict, anger, anxiety, resentment, envy, which promotes shame, which promotes fear. And it's an endless cycle, even for us sophisticated men of the 21st century. This cycle of fear and shame and resentment, it's one that exists in us as well. And we see that Adam and Eve didn't have this. They were really fearless. One of the first jobs that God gives Adam, I think, demonstrates the lack of fear in this environment. It's an environment none of us have ever known. There's always been fear and shame and anxiety in our world, but one of his first jobs God gives Adam is to name all the animals. And so there's a piece in this narrative where God walks and parades every living thing in front of Adam. And whatever Adam names it, that's what God calls it. And so he's walking these things through. And I think it's interesting because the Bible doesn't get this specific, but I'm assuming there was, you know, bunnies. It's cute. And rabbit, whatever the Hebrew word for bunny rabbit is. I mean, he calls it that. But at some point, as he's parading animals through there, there's a lion that walks in front of him. And we don't see anything that says Adam ran or called out to God to protect him, but yet lion, tiger, bear. Adam is fearless in the face of what, for us, unless we're carrying two or three guys and two or three guns, we're scared to death, even as grown men. And he's not afraid. This is a place of perfect peace. And even the things that would make the normal man afraid for Adam are just not a big deal because there's no reason to fear. God is with him. God is for him. And that's enough. He's not afraid of anything in the physical realm. He's not afraid of Eve. Their nakedness is not a shameful nakedness. They don't even know what it means to be naked. That's all they know. They're in shalom. They're in perfect peace. And that's what Eden was. Eden was also the blueprint for what God intended the rest of the world to become. So this idea of shalom, it's what God really intended all of earth to be. And it starts in Eden, and we'll find as we work through the next few weeks, something happened. We know what it is that broke the whole system. But God's mission from the very beginning has always been that the rest of the world become like Eden. Not that the whole world's going to become a garden. In fact, if you look in Revelation, the word picture that God uses is not garden, but city. It's really about a city, but in the end, it's about this shalom being ever increasing throughout the world. And our work, whatever it is we do, is a big part of that. And we're going to talk about that here in a second. But God intends for our work to be part of his mission to expand shalom, peace, his kingdom, into every nook and cranny of the world. And each of us has a really unique role to play in that. And I think most of us tend to underestimate what that role is. We're going to keep talking about Adam, but what I want us to do for a second is kind of pull up here in a second and think about our workplaces. We know they're flawed. We know they're broken. Tad's going to talk about the fall next week and how sin entered the world and changed everything when it came to work. But imagine for me, just for a second, what it would be like if your workplace was free of shame, both in you and in the people you worked with or studied with, free of shame, free of fear, free of hostility, free of conflict, free of anxiety, free of anger, resentment, and envy. Just take a second to think about that. Think about the relationships you have with coworkers, bosses, direct reports, patients, clients. Think about all of those words and how it's embedded and buried, even in the best ones. Envy, hostility, disappointment, frustration, conflict. Think of what your work would be like if none of that was there. None of it. All those things were imaginary. They weren't there at all. And then think for a second that alongside that there was perfect peace, shalom, this flourishing that we're talking about. What would it be like if all that would, I mean, I can't even imagine that. So much of our work is actually created to mitigate the flaws and mistakes of others. So much of our law is built to punish the flaws and mistakes of others. Everything in our society is built around the idea that there is not shalom, that we can't even imagine life that way. It's going to be something we talk about in our questions, but what would work be like if it was pure peace, if it was like Eden? We know one day that's coming, and I think part of our job is to figure out how to make a little bit of that a reality now. So God commissions a place for Adam to do this first work, but he also commissions a job for Adam that is important and rewarding. We're going to see it in Genesis 1, 28 through 31, if you want to look at that with me. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was good. It was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So there's God, there's Adam, there's Eve, and God commissions them with this job to rule and subdue, to fill, to multiply, to work the land. Everything is for his purposes. The birds are there to eat. The food is there for him. It's all for him. God is for him. And God has invited Adam into this co-laboring, this co-working with God in his mission. And this is the very beginning of it. Now, this is true of us too. God has invited us into his mission, but I'll be honest. I know that God intends for that news to thrill me, that God has invited me into his mission. That's supposed to thrill me like nothing else, but it doesn't really. If anything, I'm kind of assumed that, yeah, but it doesn't really motivate or drive me on a daily basis. And if you're anything like me, the idea that God has invited you in whatever it is you're doing right now to be a part of his bigger mission in that work, not just by sharing what you know about him, but even by the way you do it and the reasons you do it, God has invited you to co-labor with him in ways that he doesn't need, but he chooses. That's underwhelming to us. It really is. We would have an easier time imagining a president inviting us to do some kind of foreign relations on behalf of the country, or Tim Cook inviting us to Apple headquarters to help design the next iPhone. I mean, we can almost picture that, and that sounds a little bit engaging, but the God of the universe inviting us in to co-labor with him in his great mission, it's like, I mean, oh, okay. I mean, that's fine, sure. That sounds like a churchy thing, but it doesn't thrill us. And I think there's a few reasons it doesn't. It's not because it's not thrilling, because I think it is. I think Adam would have seen it that way. And I think the Old Testament patriarchs, as they came face to face with God, realized what God was asking about, and they were floored. But I think there's a few reasons why we're not. One is this: you and I tend to really underestimate the grace and the glory of God when it comes to our relationship with him. And so we tend to underestimate grace, meaning we forget how far God had to come, not just to make our work meaningful, to make our lives matter. How far God had to come in the person and the work of Jesus Christ to redeem us and reconcile us from rebellion and from being obstinate, being ones who rejected him outright with our lives and with our words and with our minds and our hearts. How far God had to come in grace to rescue us, we forget that on a daily basis. And so that God might invite us into something else, just like grace, we think, oh yeah, of course, sure, that's no big deal. The second thing I think is that we way underestimate the glory of God. When it says that God is inviting us in to work with him, part of what we forget is grace, but part of what we forget is the glory of the idea that God himself has invited us to work with him. We underestimate the glory of God. When I meet celebrity, you know, you'll be somewhere, maybe on a plane, you're at an airport, you run into maybe a celebrity or an athlete, and I'll run into these people, and I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna go introduce myself, and I fumble all over my words. I don't know exactly what to say, act like a fool. Can I take a picture with you? I mean, it's ridiculous, and I know they see that all the time. You get in the presence of even human greatness, and you get a little nervous. You're not sure exactly what to do. And you know they're just men or women, but you still get a little nervous. When people came into contact with just the messengers of God, they fell on their face, afraid they were going to die immediately. Not because the messenger or because God was scary, but because he was so infinitely grand that they were worried if they were going to even survive the encounter. It's a lot like if we were to walk up to the edge of the Grand Canyon without the little railing and just kind of peer over and look down. That feeling when your stomach moves up into your chest because you're just not sure. It's too deep for you and you know it, and it's thrilling and scary all at the same time. That's what would happen if God himself were to even bring a bit of his presence into this room. We'd all hit our faces like that and wonder if we were going to survive the encounter. That's what it means in a little way to understand the glory of God. And so when God says, I'm inviting you men into my work, we don't sense that all the time. We're like, oh God, yeah, it's God. We're so familiar with God that we've forgotten how big and how mighty and how grand and how otherworldly he is. I think Adam had a sense of this, which is why Adam understood the role he was given. So grace and glory, that's one reason why we tend to way underestimate what it means to work alongside God. But the second thing is this, we're not great at working with anybody. I mean, even those of us who work on teams and work in businesses where we have to really rely on one another, we're not great at it. We don't really like the idea of co-working anyway. Just let me handle it is kind of our motto. When I take my kids to work, sometimes they'll have an off day and they want to come to work with me. And like, let's go to work with Dad, great. And what that usually means, I'm an investment consultant, so we work with nonprofits and individuals and help them with their investment planning and portfolios. And so, you know, my kids aren't really qualified to do that yet at this age. And so what I usually do when we work with Dad is they sit in the corner with highlighters and paper and they draw things. And so, we worked with Dad. I mean, yeah, not really, but they had fun and they loved it and that's really what counts. But in no meaningful way did they work with me that day. Tad Pruitt spoke to us last week. Tad's an orthopedic surgeon. He did some work and fixed my shoulder last year, needed some help on it, and he worked it. You know, Tad didn't really offer for me to co-labor with him on the surgery. You know, what he didn't say was, Mike, we're gonna get in there. I'm going to clean some stuff up. I'm going to make sure it looks okay. And then if you'll close up when I'm done, if you'll just put the stitches in, that'll be good. That'll let me move on to the next thing. He didn't invite me into that. You know what he said? He said, go to sleep. You go to sleep, and when I'm done, we'll wake you up. In fact, he didn't even say it. He had someone else tell me to go to sleep. He had a nurse tell me to count backwards from 10. Like, that's how much he delegated that stuff. He wasn't willing to co-work with me at all, and for good reason. An orthopedic surgeon doesn't need an investment guy to tell him how to do surgery. But we projected that kind of thing, that kind of independent thinking, our specialty, whatever that is, we project that onto God, and we think, God's so big, he really doesn't need us. He's so smart, he doesn't really want us. Or we're so smart, we really don't need him. We're so specialized and fancy now, we don't really need God. We're really not great at seeing grace and glory, but we're really not good at co-laboring with anyone, much less God himself. And so we tend to underestimate the thrilling notion that God would invite us into his work. But I think Adam got it. Three things we'll point out about Adam's work. One, Adam as the bearer of God's image was to do a work similar to God's. Adam could not create out of nothing as God had done, but he could develop the raw materials to expand the garden until it covered the whole earth. This has to do with our second point in the sense that Adam's not God. He can't make things from nothing. He can't bury them in the ground the way God did for future generations to find, but he could cultivate the soil right in front of him. And in doing so, he brought plants up out of the ground. He probably the first time thought he did that. He thought he created this tree out of nothing. God knew better, but in the end, Adam's work was similar to God's work. Not in every way, not that he created from nothing, but Adam was creating in a different way. And because Adam was an image bearer of God, it makes sense that his work would be something of the image of God's work. And it's one thing that, it'll be a question, I think, for small group time, but one thing we can do as we start to develop this idea of calling is to think, in what ways is your work like God's work? I don't mean in the preaching of the good news, although that's a part of what we do as God's workers, but in what ways is your specific work like God's work? To the extent that you're a counselor, how is that like Jesus, who's called Wonderful Counselor? How is your counsel somewhat like Jesus' counsel? If you're a staff accountant and you reconcile numbers all day, How is that work similar to God's work as a reconciler of humanity to himself? There are ways that we can connect our work to God's work, and it becomes a display, an image of his greater glory, of his greater work. We have to begin to make these connections. If that line of God's work from past through the present to the future is the thing we want to hook onto, we have to start to think well about how our work really images God's work in real specific, concrete, down-to-earth ways. But Adam's work was similar to God's. So is ours. Number two, God put Adam in Eden to work it and to keep it. Adam was to be both a gardener and a guardian of Eden. There was no division of work between sacred and secular. Physical work was also very spiritual because it glorified God, fulfilled God's purposes for the world he made. So Adam is in the garden. He is a gardener and a guardian. I love those two words. He is a cultivator of the ground, and he's a protector. You know, we make divisions as men because work is so central to our identity, and we talked a lot about that last term in men's ministry. It's the first thing we ask one another. Besides, you know, what's your name? We say, what do you do? Because that's as near to our identity as our name. I'm Mike, and I'm a this. And we talked about how to disconnect some of that we should find most of our identity in who God says we are and who we are in him. But the reality is we still let those vocational functions determine who we are for others and for ourselves. So we create all these divisions, sacred, secular. We create those. You know, ministry work and the real world. We create those. Blue collar, white collar. We create those. We're the ones that create those kinds of divisions. God does not. So in the beginning, you have Adam, who is both blue collar and white collar. He's both working the ground with his hands, and he's the executive of the whole thing. He's overseeing the whole thing. God, throughout his plan, as you see him folding different families and different men, you see him calling carpenters. You see him calling fishermen. You see him calling tent makers. You see him calling doctors. You see him calling lawyers. You see him calling all different kinds of vocations into the same vocation, which is to make his name famous in the whole earth through their vocation, among other things. The divisions that we make between sacred and secular, between blue and white collar, these are artificial distinctions that we make. That whether you work with your hands, whether you make the earth more beautiful, like my friend Samuel does, who makes sure that God's creation stays in its place and looks as beautiful as Adam would have made it look, that's a holy calling from God. It is. And no matter what it is you do, God intends for it to be a sacred calling. As we think about how we can connect it to his work, we can find that there's not any work in the world that is true to God's purposes that isn't significant and sacred. All work is sacred. To those who are in ministry, that is a special calling. Vocational ministry is important and it's necessary, but so is tax preparation, and so is government, and so is investment planning, and so is legal work, and so is orthopedic surgery, and everything in between. It's all absolutely necessary, which takes us to the third point. Adam exercised dominion over creation, not as an owner, but as a trustee. He worked under God's authority as the ultimate owner for everything. The reality is we work for God. Through all of these vocations, all of these callings, all are sacred. The truth is we work for God. At our worst, without a clear view of work and God, front and center of our lives every day, every single one of us will bend towards one pole of error. We will either think that we're a pretty big deal, we'll have quite a bit of self-importance. We won't call ourselves God, because people who do that usually end up dead. You don't go around calling yourself God. But what we will do is we'll think we're God compared to everyone else. We will overvalue our contributions, overvalue our intellect, overvalue our decision-making, overvalue our opinion. We'll overvalue everything because we think we're a pretty big deal. And this idea that Adam wasn't the owner, but he was a trustee, he was a manager, he was a steward, he was a priest of this place, the garden, and of God's work, is meant to, for those of us who bend in that direction, humble us. Because we work for God. We don't own this thing. This profession isn't ours. This clinic isn't ours. This job isn't ours, this practice isn't ours, this equipment isn't really ours, it is God's. If we're God's, and we are, then everything we have is his, including our lives, and it's all God's. So for those of us who tend to be self-important, little demigods who run around thinking we're a really big deal and the world ought to cater us, just know we work for God. But many of us swing the other direction, and we tend to think in self-pity that our work isn't that important, and who sees and who knows, and is this ever going to really make a difference? Can this little thing I'm doing ever really make a big dent in the mission that God's on in the world throughout thousands of years of history? Does this little thing, security cop at the mall, does this little thing really even matter? And the same phrase applies. We work for God. Like we don't work for the mall or for the people we work for. We do in one sense, but we work for God. When we think what we do doesn't matter, we have to remember that God himself is the one we work for. It's meant to humble some of us, but it's also meant to exalt some of us out of our misery to say that God has called us to something very special, and there is nothing, not one job, not one vocation that is small enough to be absolutely dignified and royal if we work for God. And so some of us, our pride says that we're a really big deal. And some of us, our pride says that we're not a big enough deal, that God couldn't ever use us. And the reality is God can use anything and is determined to use everything in order to accomplish his plans. He both doesn't need us and absolutely chooses to integrate us. From the way he created, by leaving discoveries out there for us to still be refining and working on as men thousands of years after Adam, to the place that he created, the garden, in which we're to expand through our different callings to the ends of the earth. The reality is you and I are no longer slaves moving rocks back and forth in our jobs, even though it feels that way some days. In the gospel, we're sons now. We're in the family business. The family business is bringing the glory of God to every nook and cranny of the universe. Your nook and cranny is not the same as mine. You're going to have access to places in God's creation that I'm never going to have access, and only you can bring God's glory there through your work. And what we want to do over the next few weeks is to continue to see how God's work informs our work and how our work can really bring that glory to bear on those little places. We're going to jump in a small group. Let me pray for us real quick. God, thank you for the fact that you were a worker before we showed up, and that even as you planned our creation, you were preparing the earth for our work, that it wouldn't be meaningless toil, but that God, ultimately, through your son and in your son, our work would have as much meaning as you would give it, which is a lot, that you would use us, no matter what our skills or what our education or what our intelligence, you would use us to accomplish your mission on the earth, which is to bring that glory, that unbelievable glory that we so often underestimate, to every nook and cranny of the earth. I pray that you give my friends and me the vision to see a little bit more of that glory, a little bit more of the grace that makes it possible. Would we see it, and would we begin to see a clear line between it, our work, and your purposes in the earth? We need you. We're so short-sighted. We're so blind at times. We don't see all that we could. We need you to do that for us. In Christ's name, amen.